Everyone to today's policy in practice seminar with Professor Greg Fisher. Also welcome our Dean Andres Velasco and our incoming Professor in practice Vanessa Rubio. Welcome everyone. As you all know, the purpose of these seminars is to bring the world of practice into the world of academia, since that's one of the fundamental principles that we try to uphold in at the School of Public Policy. Not just to teach analytics, but also be mindful of the world of practice and also equip our students to make a difference in the world of practice by already bringing in the world of practice into what they think, how they study, and how they think of public policy and how they design. So today we are very lucky to have a speaker who brings a huge amount of valuable experience, but also insights into this. I know Greg for more than a decade, first at MIT briefly, but then for over a decade, he has been a colleague at the LSE and also worked with me at the International Growth Center. So Greg is one of those people who has high credibility, both in the world of academia and practice, started off at Princeton. And if I were to embarrass him, was one of the favorite students of Angus Deaton, the Nobel laureate, and then went into the world of practice at Wall Street and other places, finance, high finance, and all kinds of things. Came back to studied at MIT, was very close to Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee and others. Again, they were Nobel laureates last year, so one prediction from whosoever closely works or whosoever Greg chooses to work with is that they do very well. So it's selection. I don't know which way the selection goes, but tells you something about the match. And then Greg worked at LSE for 10 years. He was one of the most popular teachers at the School of Public Policy. In fact, at this in economics, an extremely popular teacher because he took teaching very seriously and also introduced all kinds of innovations there. And he also worked with me, his own research is in mostly in development economics, but also in finance, in all corners of the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, elsewhere. But he also took a career move from studying access to finance and microfinance and finance in the small F to working in finance in the big F, finance in development. How do you crowd in, call it private finance or impact investing and bringing it to the world of policy and development. So he's working as a research director at Y Analytics for quite a while. So there are a number of themes that he has worked on or that he has thought about quite a lot that would be relevant for our discussion today. What do we think of public policy and economic development, and how should we as both as students and as practitioners think about this? Is it primarily about technical knowledge, or is it also about other constraints to public policy? And those constraints could come from politics, could implementation, from the world of practice and other things. And maybe there are some themes here for our students also, and also for people like me and others. How should we think of public policy? How should we be training ourselves and maybe teaching public policy differently in a School of Public Policy like the SPP? And for our students, how should you be thinking differently about how do you prepare best for the world that you, for the world in public policy that you will be experiencing? Also his work in, I think, finance, both his work in access to finance, but also his current work. How do you solve the financing challenge? And it's not just a financing challenge in development. It's also a question of incentives, institutions, and governance. And is it only about governments doing the right thing? Is it about bilateral, multilateral institutions? What role does the private sector have, international finance has? And maybe he can say something about that also. Still another theme that he thinks quite a lot is about evidence-based policy formulation. That's related to the first theme also about how do we think about evidence? What is evidence? Is it the papers that you read about and published in QJE and AER, and or is it something else? And how do the two relate? So both the technical knowledge that you gain, analytical skill that you gain, but also about all the other things that we bring to a public policy challenge. And how do we integrate the two? So not raising expectations. I hope, Greg, I myself have been looking forward to this talk for a long time. So without further ado, over to you, Greg. So the way we'll run it, Greg will say something, and we first, like a, maybe in a small group, Vanessa, Andres, and myself will ask him and maybe converse with him a few times, and then we'll open up to. So be ready with your questions, comments, everything. Over to you, Greg.
Great. Well, first, Adnan, thank you for a far too kind introduction. You did succeed in embarrassing me, and I only hope that if my lucky association with Nobel laureates, really is, in some way causal, that we'll be celebrating your Nobel in about 12 years if things stay on schedule. So you have to keep it up. So let's see. So first of all, thank you. It's great to see lots of you here, or at least the names of another kind of dozen or so folks on the Zoom screen as well. What I'd like to do, actually, following some guidance from Adnan, is just flesh out a tiny little bit of my background, because I think it's always helpful in these conversations to have a bit of a sense of people's perspective or frankly what axe they may have to grind, so you can hopefully triangulate in on a truth or your truth along the way there. And then I'll answer a question that Adnan asked me in advance, which is to talk a very little bit about, whether or not some of the technical things that you guys learn that we teach through the School of Public Policy, how those can actually be useful in the so-called real world. And then what I'd like to do then is just kind of open it up to discussion and questions, as Adnan said, maybe, kind of in an increasingly kind of larger group. So just kind of, two things to flesh out in my background. First, I started off in private equity in the early 1990s. And it was this, really interesting day of redefinition of what finance actually was. And I should admit, it wasn't by design. It was really an accident. I borrowed what I've now heard is referred to as a shed load of money to pay for my undergraduate education at Princeton. And my, my intention was really just to actually spend a couple of years, frankly, paying down some student loans, which I know many of you are well versed in, and then go back into academia. And what I found was that the work I was doing in private equity was actually much more interesting than I think I had given credit for. Angus Deaton, for whom I have almost boundless respect for, had said to me before I left to go work there, he said, look, be careful working in finance. Many people in that line actually just forget how to think, and it would be a pity if it happened to, to someone who, think could be a decent academic. And, his view has changed somewhat more slowly than mine, because I was fully embroiled in it. But I recognized that many of the tools that I'd been learning in economics, although they weren't necessarily directly applicable to the kind of work that I was doing, actually bits of them thoughtfully applied could make a real difference and generate lots of value. And so it took on a bit of a life of its own. I spent 10 years in private equity doing. And for those of you who don't know private equity, it's kind of a bit of an arcane world. Basically, people from kind of, pension funds, insurance companies, high net worth individuals, sovereign governments give you a pool of money. You go out there and you buy typically the equity of private, so non-publicly traded companies, and attempt to increase the value. There was a time when what most people did was buy them and kind of carve them up for pieces. None of you are probably old enough to remember what was the barbarians at the gate version of private equity, but it was mostly kind of stripping down companies for parts. Most of what we tried to do was to grow businesses. And that was very interesting because I had an interest in development and thought, hey, here's an area where we might be able to find ways to put together some of those skills and an understanding of what social and environmental impacts are, but in a way that actually informs some of the work that we do. And that was, in the very early days of people thinking about kind of the ideas of ESG, these environmental, social, and governance issues, in a way that didn't really kind of take hold at the time. So after about 10 years of doing that, I did a very brief stint at the World Bank, and then headed off to MIT, sort of affectionately known as Nerd Paradise, to get a PhD. And the thing that brought me back, which I think speaks a lot to why I love the School of Public Policy so much, was that there was this revolution in economics where people thought that the advent of randomized controlled trials, basically the kind of A-B test that you see for medical trials, if you haven't kind of been fully steeped in them yet, those kind of A-B tests that you use to say, hey, does this kind of drug or this vaccine kind of work relative to a placebo, were starting to be used to inform policy decisions, right? Should I, you know, what is the effect of providing microcredit to individuals? What is the effect of providing access to clean drinking water by kind of filters or by public pumps? Kind of what can we actually bring evidence to bear on a lot of these really pressing kind of global policy questions? And it was this chance to actually kind of be there at the foundational stages of that, you know, of that revolution is probably not too strong of a word. And so, you know, went to MIT to do that in 2008, joined LSE. And I'll say that one of the things that, so the thing that both excited me and frustrated me about that and why the School of Public Policy is such a wonderful place is that the field of dreams approach to building evidence just doesn't work, right? This idea that if you build it, people will make better decisions is a fallacy that I think almost everybody, and you know, if you get a chance to talk to Lant Pritchett, he's been one of the loudest kind of voices along this line. Like you can build what seems like better evidence and then present it in this kind of beautiful wrapped up QJE article to a policymaker and they'll say, yeah, that's not what I'm interested in. And so what I recognize is that you know, had the opportunity to bring my background of spending 10 years in the private sector, combining that with some of the skills that we have developed on the academic side to actually find ways to find the right entry point for these types of decisions. And, you know, people like, you know, Adnan and Andras are great examples of others who have found ways to kind of, you know, bridge these gaps. And so, about in 2017, I'd been spending lots of time on the side doing kind of various consulting projects for everybody from governments to large corporates, was contacted by folks at an organization called the RISE Fund. You may or may not have heard of them, but what they were was they were a piece of a very large asset manager called TPG. TPG at the time had about $120 billion of assets under management. And one of the partners at the firm, along with Jeff Skoll from the Skoll Foundation and Bono from Bono, I guess you two, kind of got together and said, hey, people are out there doing this thing called impact investing. What it means is this idea that we can actually align our broader set of values, right? The things that we care about for what are outcomes for people and the planet with our investment decisions. And if we do that and we start thinking about not just what our financial returns are, but actually what the impact that we're going to have on kind of people and the planet, we might be able to draw kind of really serious amounts of private capital to address some of the biggest problems facing the world. And to put that in perspective, if you believe the numbers that the UN puts out for what's required to hit the targets of the Sustainable Development Goals, these targets that kind of, you know, were put together now, gosh, nearly a decade ago to think about, you know, how to make progress towards reducing poverty, reducing inequality, improving educational outcomes, the funding gap to hit that target is somewhere between $2.5 and $3.5 trillion a year, right? It's not a small number. And so when you think about the kind of resources that can be brought to bear by kind of all the philanthropies in the world or all the governments in the world, they make a big difference here. But, you know, the total global financial assets are $300 trillion. And so if you can take those and just direct them a little bit more towards things that make the world, frankly, a slightly less crummy place, you know, maybe that can start filling in some of the gap. So the set of folks had said, look, we're going to create this fund called the RISE Fund. And the idea was, look, let's see if instead of making investments on the order of $500,000 in these sorts of things that address the world's problems, let's start making investments on the order of $50 or $100 million and really creating a market and showing that it's possible to do this at an institutional scale. And you know, they talked to me and you know, made a compelling pitch to say, look, what we really need is somebody who can combine some practical kind of real world experience with all the technical rigor that's out there, because we need credibility to actually demonstrate and know whether or not we're addressing these challenges. But at the same time, it needs to be pragmatic. It needs to work for the folks who are out there doing this. So I went and I joined the RISE Fund at a group called RISE Labs back in 2018. We spun off as a separate entity called Y Analytics. But the whole idea actually Bono came up with the name. And the idea was to bring research and capital together for a company good. You can imagine what a Y looks like if you have a more creative sense of vision than I do. And so the idea was to say, look, we can actually bring this rigor and large amounts of financial capital together to help improve kind of where capital is being allocated to, again, address some of the world's biggest problems. And so kind of that's what I'm doing now. And what's been really interesting over the last couple of years is just the exponential growth in the number of people who are thinking about the possibilities of doing this. So if you believe kind of what the dollar amounts are, the size of capital, the amount of capital that's dedicated to impact investing, this sort of thing, has grown from about $300 billion in total to about $2.5 trillion in total. And kind of broader sustainable capital is about $30 trillion of total assets. And so, that gets me kind of to a bit of my background. Any questions on that before I kind of try to answer the one question that Adnan posed to me in advance of, so is any of this technical stuff actually useful? I'll take silence as consent. Yeah.
Let's take it as a ringing endorsement and carry forward.
Yeah, either that or Zoom broke down. So Adnan posed the question, look, is any of this technical stuff useful? I spend probably, too much of my spare time thinking about it, exactly that. And I think there's some version of the phrase that, we should take all of the technical work that we've seen kind of seriously, but not literally. It is probably not a bad approximation of at least what my view is. And again, take my view with an enormous grain of salt, kind of given what my background is. I think, one of the real advantages of the School of Public Policy is this idea to really embed a deeper sense of pragmatism in the way that a lot of the technical tools are actually being used. And I'll elaborate a little bit on what I mean by that. You'll see in all the work that you do through the program that there's still a long way to go, but you guys, the set of you kind of gathered on this call, are, I think, uniquely positioned to actually make use of this and also kind of pull the usefulness of all of the technical things we do forward. And so, what do I mean by that, right? There was a professor of mine at MIT actually made an observation that has proven to be more true than I could have possibly imagined. He said, look, PhD students sit in a classroom and they listen to their professors and they think, I want to be him or her. And I'll be fair, like maybe not so much wanting to be me, but they want to be sort of Esther DeFlo or Tim Besley or Raj Chetty or kind of that set of folks. And they take largely the direction of travel as given. They say, look, how can I push the envelope? But I believe that you're pointing in the right direction. And I'm going to kind of pull this forward. I'm going to address some gaps, but I want to do sort of what you do. On the other end of the spectrum are business school students. And I think, they are substantially more mercenary. Right? They look at the faculty and think, look, if you had anything useful to say, you'd be running your own hedge fund right now and dialing in from someplace in the, in the Caymans. And I think being an MPA student or an MPP student kind of puts you in this enviable position of being kind of right in the sweet spot in the middle, where there's a set of tools that you have a bit of experience to recognize that these can actually be useful. But you don't take them quite so literally to think that these are the end all and be all sets of things that should answer every question. And I think that kind of hybrid is actually incredibly useful for policy. And I use policy in a very kind of broad definition, because if you think about my background, I haven't gone out and worked for Treasury. I spent a bit of time at the World Bank, but most of the work that I've done has been at this interface between the private sector and organizations that that are actually trying to accomplish some of the goals that we normally associate with with policy. Because the reality is that in real life, unlike what academia looks like and unlike what some slices of your classes look like, you're not so much trying to write or evaluate one paper and decide its merits to to be in the AER or the QJE. Rather, you're trying to aggregate some evidence and theory from a lot of different sources. And in a very imperfect world, make the best decision you possibly can. I should qualify that remark in one way. It would be kind of nice if the world actually worked that way, but I think real life has two really big impediments, and I'll kind of mention these, and then I'll turn it over to more conversations. I think the first big impediment is if we really thought that kind of what we were actually trying to do is aggregate all the evidence and theory that we have together to make the best decisions. The dirty little secret is that nobody really knows exactly how to do that. We're all kind of just making it up as we go along. But there are these real moments of clarity along the way there, moments where you say things like, look, I actually know something about externalities. And so this program that you think is great, that you want to go out and invest, you know, $20 million in, actually is going to have some really serious kind of negative impacts. And if we don't take those and kind of measure those in a credible way, we could actually be doing harm when we think we're doing good. Or it might be that, you know, from econometrics, you know something about selection bias, and this program that somebody says, look, we're going to shut down because it isn't working, you actually have the sense to recognize, look, it's selecting in a whole set of individuals who actually need it most. And so although their outcomes don't look better than anybody else, their ability to get back to this base level is entirely the product of the program. And you should actually continue supporting that program. And it's awesome when you have these moments of clarity where the little bits of knowledge that you've built up through the technical skills of the program find that they create kind of real insights into how, you know, policies or programs or products actually ought to work. And I think, and you know, this is, you know, I'll say this, it's nice to have, you know, Andres and you know, Adnan on the phone here. I think the evolution of the School of Public Policy is making real progress here. I think that it was often a challenge, I think, to recognize the real opportunity that was there when everything that exists in a School of Public Policy actually existed in departments that had their own set of agendas, which was publishing economics papers or publishing kind of government papers. And I think the recognition that policy is something really special, right? It's not just about writing papers. It's about finding a set of tools that allow you to make better decisions to achieve the outcomes you care about. Is a real field in and of itself, and kind of watching all the pieces fit together that you guys are all part of is just super exciting. It's one of the kind of great parts about being part of the program, and you can all kind of have a moment of kind of, you know, gratitude for all that, I hope, because it's just amazing. I think the second kind of, you know, impediment or challenge that's kind of, you know, worth addressing is that, you know, we talk a lot about evidence-based policymaking or some version of that. But as many of you probably already know, in the real world, there's a lot of what I'll call policy-based evidence making, right? Which is, you know, one of the best anecdotes that spelled this out for me, I was teaching in the executive MPA program. And one of the folks who was in the program came up and said to me, look, Greg, I love all the stuff you're teaching. It's great to get a sense of how this should actually work in practice. But let me tell you how reality works. My minister comes to me and tells me, hey, here's what we're gonna do. What I need you to do is put a brief together that tells everybody else that that's the right thing to do, right? And that sequence is something is very different than what we would think of as the natural kind of scientific process of figuring out what the right answer actually is. You know, I guess what I'd call sort of the dual or the other side of that that makes it work, you know, a very famous econometrician who I was fortunate enough to have as a professor at one point in time said to me, he said, look, we have all these great tools that can tell you what the right answer is. But let me tell you the truth, right? I run a consulting practice, and for the right amount of money, I'm a good enough econometrician that I can get you whatever answer you want, right? And have you convinced that it's the right answer. And so I think that one of the great skills that you get out of the MPA program and seeing this more and more is that kind of critical eye, right? That, you know, not everything is kind of a pure yes or no answer, but being able to have a critical view so you can think about how to put your own ideas together and have them kind of be as well informed as possible, recognizing that the world has kind of lots of gray out there. And so, I think that, you know, what I've seen is two things that I think are probably useful is one, the number of times when I've just spotted opportunities in the quote unquote real world where there's just low-hanging fruit where a little understanding of some of the technical materials that are kind of just the core of what you do within the MPA can really change people's thinking and hopefully for the better is much larger than I think you would have expected. Right? We have this idea that all the sort of the good ideas have already percolated throughout, but sometimes really simple conversations that would feel really simple after your first year of an MPA or the MPP program are just lights that go on for the way people think about things. The other thing that's noticeable is just how many former students from the MPA program are out there working in the areas that I find myself in, impact investing and sustainability, you know, and the like, and how valuable most, I'll say most, it's not quite all, but how valuable most of them have found the work that you guys are doing in their practical lives. They have been able to leaven it with, you know, quite a bit of salt that goes along with that. But a sense of a lot of things that you guys do actually really make a difference in the day-to-day work that they do. I'll leave my sort of pontificating to that, and then, you know, happily kind of, you know, open it up to questions or more conversations, because hopefully that's a lot more fun.
Thank you, Greg. Let me first invite maybe Andres and Vanessa, in case you want to either comment or have a question, you want to come into the discussion.
I'm going to ask. Oh, Vanessa, please go ahead. Go ahead. I'll come in later.
Thank you. Well, thanks for your comments, Greg. I think you gave a great snapshot of what, if I imagine myself when I studied back in the mid 1990s at the LSE, and after a 25-year career in public sector, it's the kind of input you would like someone to give you before you jump into the waters of public policy or considering public policy as your career. I think I would go from the micro to the macro comments. One very micro comment that you made, it might be very obvious, but just for the students that are listening today, I think that having in mind order of magnitude to provide information to this minister that your student was right. working with, it's so relevant. You spoke about the funding gap between the SDGs and the global financial assets dedicated that can be dedicated to partly addressing these goals. That's such a relevant reference point for any policymaker. I just wanted to say this again, because I had teams of 4,000 people, and I had teams of 10 people, no? But whenever someone gave you information for a decision-making process, order of magnitude is very relevant. You don't want someone saying, oh, there's large numbers of migrants coming from the Northern Triangle to Mexico. You want to know what's a lot, no? And a lot compared to what? And, you know, so I just wanted to say how relevant orders of magnitude are in order to make good decision making in public policy. And then the second point I wanted to say is that everything in life leaves you a lesson. It's all about building blocks. Like even the tiniest job, the most insignificant experience that you might feel you're faced with is useful for your next step. And it gives you information, and it gives you reference point, and it gives you experience, and it gives you context, and it gives you framework. So just listen, students, to what just Greg told us. And he's been building blocks throughout his life. And the fact that he had to first work in private equity to finance his studies, you know, how that was a building block for the next thing and how that took him to the next, point of his career. And now he has a dream job that touches on my third point, which is basically you can have a dream job that maybe it does not exists at this point. So you don't have to think yourself, as the minister or as the deputy minister or as the, you know, there's traditional jobs, and it's nice to be a minister. I'm sure, Andres, and it's nice to be a deputy minister. I am sure because I've been one 3 times in Mexico. But you can always think about that dream job that builds on all your experience, that builds on all of your background, and that you create a niche, because there's niches everywhere. And that niche can be, occupied by someone like you, but that niche can also be maximized by someone like you. So I just wanted to touch on these 3 points. I said very micro and very macro, but just there's a notion of opportunities out there to work in public policy, and you can make mixes. It's not like the traditional positions anymore. So now the world needs more flexibility in every single area of life, and I think and I look forward to you providing that so we can have a better world in general. So thank you, Greg. I really enjoyed the focus you gave to your presentation and the way you threaded like the different building blocks in your life that got you to where you are. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Vanessa.
So maybe Greg, you, Let Andres also make his comment or question, and maybe you can respond to both at the same time.
I mean, I'll make one very quick comment, and then I was going to ask a question that Vanessa semi-asked, so I will rephrase it a little bit. My comment is, you guys have just heard somebody with a PhD from MIT who is a very skilled econometrician, but who at the same time is not enamored of technique alone. I mean, and you made a number of very good and quotable and insightful comments, Greg. One that stuck in my mind is your friend, the consultant, saying, I'm good enough so that I can pretty much, you know, persuade you that the data say whatever my client wants the data to say. I write theory papers, or I used to write theory papers with a guy who was a brilliant mathematician. We'd give him two beers. He would say, you know, I am so good, I can prove theorems that are right. And if you push me, I can also prove theorems that are wrong. You know, scientific skill is very important, but it's not the end of the world. So I think that's exactly, my comment is to the students, that's exactly the right attitude with which to approach the learning of quantitative methods, econometrics, et cetera. My question or my request to you, Greg, is quite similar to what Vanessa said at the very end. If you're a guy with gray hair like myself, you tend to put jobs and careers into neat cubbyholes. You know, you either become a public servant, you know, and you work in the government, or you're an academic and you write papers, or you go to Wall Street and you become rich, but they're very distinct. You're a very good example that the world is no longer like that, and that you can do, you know, impact investing, and you can, you know, think about the public good and the private sector. That's much preferred to thinking about the private good and the public sector. That's called corruption. Now, we don't teach that sort of thing. I was hoping you could tell our students a bit more of how you see these mixed careers evolving. What, you know, you said a little bit about your experience, but maybe tell us a little bit how you think that could be generalizable. Talking to students, I get this question a lot. You know, they say, I kind of like the government, but I don't want to be a bureaucrat. And I kind of like the private sector because it's dynamic, but I don't want to spend my money all my life just trying to get my next sort of consulting gig or my next deal. So how do I think about these mixed, I'll use the term du jour, hybrid, right? We do hybrid teaching. We also do hybrid careers. Tell us a bit more about that.
Gosh, that's a great point and a great kind of set of questions. I think that, I'll echo something that Vanessa said, right? You know, everything in life gives you a lesson, right? And in the sense in which we're trying to answer lots of questions, the ability to have different, sometimes unique perspectives is extremely valuable. And I think that in part, that's because it feels like I have the start of some gray hair here as well. It's just bad lighting, right? Hides it well. And I think that the pace of change in terms of the workplace is, you know, kind of, it's well documented that that's accelerating, right? And so people spend less time at jobs, what kind of job descriptions are rarely stays the same from year to year. Increasingly, that's true quarter to quarter. And so the ability to stitch together a set of experiences and skills is becoming increasingly important for just adapting to that pace of evolution. And you see that reflected in changes in the kind of positional definitions, right? Where there are kind of new jobs where you have like heads of thought leadership at big organizations. Why do you have that? Because they couldn't think of a description because the job that the person has is changing every 3 months. Or you have, you know, senior professionals. I've been spending a lot of time recently, you know, working, with the FCDO, the kind of the Foreign Commonwealth Development Office. You have very senior people there who are coming out of consulting or banking backgrounds and saying, look, the reason why we're in this position is because people recognize that we needed kind of better measurement and management of quantifiable deliverables that are entirely tied to, say, British foreign policy and its effects, positive and negative. And we need people who have an understanding of the role of measurement as a key management tool to come in and help reinvent that. And that's not a homegrown skill for lots of the folks who come out of kind of pure policy backgrounds. And so, you know, more and more of the people that I see, and impact investing is in a sense I've seen some of the questions come through the chat. It is itself, so allow that I'm over-indexing a bit on this. Impact investing is this natural sort of hybrid profession. So it's not surprising that many of the people I come across, you know, come from this very interesting amalgam of backgrounds, right? They worked in public policy for 10 years, spent some time in finance as like a, you know, head of government relations, and are now doing something else. You see, you know, guys like, you know, Brian Deese, who's, you know, now been kind of, you know, nominated to be in Biden's cabinet, you know, who, you know, was the head of sustainable investing at BlackRock, the, you know, multi-trillion-dollar investment fund. This kind of sense of putting together very different experiences because they address a very particular goal is I mean, it feels like the norm to me in, you know, in where I work now and kind of the spaces. So, and I think that, you know, one of the great opportunities that you guys have is the incredible array of backgrounds, not just from the associated faculty, but more importantly, from your peers within the School of Public Policy. So you can kind of get a sense of, oh, hey, what did you learn doing this? What did you learn doing that? And help chart, hopefully, kind of what feel like more fruitful career decisions. Because I think one of the sad things that I've seen is some people say, look, if I want to eventually be a minister or eventually want to be a, you know, somebody who's successful as an investor, there is a single path. And if I don't get my foot on it right now, like there might be this wonderful job. I think I'm working with people who I love, where that would use all my skills, but it's not the right step on the path. It turns out kind of, you know, that kind of, you know, when in nerdy econometric terms is kind of like, you know, this very greedy gradient ascent problem, right? You find the steepest hill that looks exciting for you and you move in that direction. Turns out that actually is not a bad way to navigate careers these days, because the goal that you see in sight is, whatever, I have young kids, so it feels a bit like Hogwarts, right? The stairways are always moving inside the place, right? And so as long as you feel like you're building up your ability to navigate that, kind of where you think you're heading to is it's entirely possible that doesn't exist in 2 years. And so head in a direction that feels really good, that uses your skills, makes you happy now. And that kind of that building block where kind of everything in life gives you a lesson will, it seems like more and more that's leading you to really productive places.
Thanks, Greg.
Did that answer your question? Would that at least partially answer your question? Or at least talk about it?
Thanks, Greg. We have a lot of questions from students, so I'll take them in order. So Santiago first, why don't you, if you can, maybe turn the video on, introduce yourself and ask your question.
Thank you, Adnan, and thank you, Greg, for your words. And Adnan and Andres, thank you for organizing, and welcome, Vanessa. We're excited to have you. My question, Greg, and just to take Andres' terminology of sort of like the hybrid role within impact investing, I was just curious to learn, what do you find, how much of your time do you think you spend on like actually analyzing firms from a financial perspective? And then how much of your time are you spending looking at sort of like the impact that the firms you're investing in is having in sort of achieving these SDG goals? Thank you. Oh, sorry, I'm a second year MPA student. Sorry, forgot to.
Okay. Thanks, Santiago. Great question. Should I answer them kind of one by one or collect a couple? What's best for you guys?
Up to you. If you can hold many questions, okay. We can have two or three questions. And do you prefer that?
Yeah, I'm happy. Why don't I take two or three, and then I'll try and answer them. If there's some kind of common theme, I'll try and pull them together. So.
Okay. So Nikhil, why don't you go next?
Hi, Greg. I'm Nikhil, MPP student from School of Public Policy. So my question is, how do impact investors know how well do impact investors know the ultimate customer of investee? Or like, what is the best way to know the customer of investee for investors?
Great question. Okay,
let's take these two questions first, and then we can have the next round.
Sure. So both great questions. The first thing, let me just say, in answer to both of them, there's no common answer, and that I think that there is a wide spectrum of impact investors and a variety of different approaches to the way people do this. And so, you know, in answering Santiago's question, I'll say, you know, the answer to how much time I spend on the impact side versus the finance side, 98% on the impact side, right? The role of understanding the finance side for me, you know, and I'm lucky to have had the private equity background so I can speak the language of the investment deal teams, but is really to make sure that the kind of assumptions that are being made by the investment teams true up with the assumptions that are being made and the things that are being measured by the impact teams. And so I'll give you an example. If you have an investment in, say, an educational business, And it turns out that on the impact thesis, the idea is, look, we're providing new educational opportunities for people for whom they wouldn't otherwise be available. So the counterfactual is that these kids wouldn't be able to go on to secondary education or to go on to tertiary education, or they'd get much lower quality. And it's hitting a slice of the population for whom that's kind of what the baseline outcome is. That might be a really strong impact thesis, depending on kind of what you believe. But if you kind of dig into the financial side, and it turns out that the entire financial model is actually increasing the cost of service and targeting the top 1% and bringing people who are otherwise studying abroad to now study locally, you say, wait a minute, there's something that just doesn't true up between the financial side and the impact side. And so, you know, within the work that I do within Y-Analytics, most of the work is done to just make sure that those things are on the finance side, is done to make sure those harmonize, and all the work is done on the impact side. I'll say most of the work that we do, and I hope that this evolves, it's kind of a key piece of what I'm trying to build more broadly in the industry, is moving from doing all the work on the assessment side, kind of the impact diligence before you make investments, and more towards that measurement and accountability to answer the question that you framed it of what actually are we doing for the ultimate beneficiaries. And I think that leads into, Nikhil, to your question. There is a tremendous variation in how different impact funds are connected to the lives, the information, the experience of their customers. In some places, it's deeply embedded in the process. Starting from diligence, when they start evaluating a new enterprise, you know, part of what they'll do is actually go out and they'll hire somebody like a 60 Decibels or otherwise to go out and actually identify customers, talk to them, really understand their experience, what they see as the benefits, or in some cases, the cost of the program, people who might be adversely affected, go out and talk to them and really try and get a very deep understanding of it. On the other side of the spectrum, there are organizations that you really want to take as much as possible at completely face value what the enterprise themselves is saying about those ultimately affected kind of beneficiaries and otherwise, and have no contact whatsoever to the customer experience. There's a hybrid in the middle that I think is more aligned with a lot of the private equity and venture capital experience, which says, you know, look, one of the advantages of the broader private equity and VC world is that there are a set of skills that are important for running enterprises that are also rare, right? So you might kind of, you know, go out and invest in a company, kind of imagine in a pure financial sense and say, look, you have a great product, but your marketing team is frankly awful. We have a lot of experience. We have operating partners who have done this work. We can help you kind of build out a marketing team, a marketing plan to actually really recognize the value of your business. More and more, you're seeing impact investors who are starting to approach impact the same way, to recognize that there are tremendous economies of scale and kind of deep understanding. You say, look, I've looked at 85 educational, you know, businesses of, you know, ed tech in low-income countries that look at least a little bit similar to your business. I can transfer over some of the things that I've been able to do or see in other places that can be useful for you better understanding your customers. And so oftentimes the impact investor becomes a bit of an enabler to allow the enterprise to actually get better information. And one of the things, kind of smart theory folks, actually I've had some nice conversations with some folks in the economics department from Tim and Beslin and Matrish to kind of talk a bit about the way the incentives are here, is that there are sometimes some challenges and mismatches between kind of how you think about getting kind of hearing the customer voice, kind of how that feeds back to the investors, how that changes the way people manage. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, probably some of you on the call will do ultimately in your careers is kind of help figure out how to make that work better. So ultimately you can actually manage for social and environmental impacts with the exact same rigor that we all have taken for granted in measuring on the finance side. But there's not a kind of a one, Nikhil, to your question, there's not a one size fits all approach to how that works. And I'll say that, and that's, to be clear, you know, that's not only across entities, that's also even within entities, like within the portfolios of companies that, you know, that I've worked with, in some cases, you know, have very rich knowledge about the experience of customers or people ultimately affected. In other cases, it really all comes just from admin data from the businesses. There's a lot of variation there. Cool. Did that answer your questions, Santiago and Nikhil?
Sounds great. So we have several other people wanting to join in, but let me ask like a the way you're talking reminded me that you were a very popular teacher here, despite teaching very technical subjects, econometrics and others. And can you say something about like, yes, you were motivated to teach. And I know for a fact that you enjoyed teaching the MPAs and the MPPs more than the regular students, maybe at least equally. Can you say something about from your teaching experience of what motivated you, and did you use some different teaching methodologies, pedagogical techniques, or what does it take to teach public policy students to prepare them better for the future, their future jobs?
Oh, gosh. Wow. So let's see. So let me break that into to chunks. First of all, let me qualify my answer to the second part of their question of what it takes to teach MPA or MPP students. Look, I don't know. What I know is what worked for me. And so I wouldn't want to in any way suggest that there's a one size fits all approach. There are a lot of great teachers within the MPA and MPP program, and we have different approaches to find ways to resonate with students. I can tell you what my experience was, is it started with the belief, you know, and I say this kind of, you know, jokingly in the beginning of all, you know, my lectures when I was teaching, you know, kind of technical econometric stuff. Look, econometrics is a superpower, right? It's the ability to take data and turn it into knowledge. And there's so much data in the world that if we can start doing that, even imperfectly, we can just make better decisions. And what really motivated me to teach the MPAs and MPPs is, like, you guys are all a set of students who actually, like, I mean, I sat on the admissions committee, I read all your essays. Unless you're just feeding us a bunch of BS, you guys have done really interesting things and want to continue to do really interesting things. And so the ability to say, look, I can give you a little bit of the superpower, to the extent that I have any of it, I can share bits of that that will allow you to be more effective and actually delivering on the things that you're passionate about, that you're coming to LSE to try and improve your toolkit to actually be better at this. Like, that's a, like, I mean, what a gift to be able to do that, right? And so, I mean, it's been so rewarding for me to go out and see students who have said to me, look, that stuff that you taught me at EC 455, now SPP 455, that I thought was completely useless at the time, turns out that's what I've been spending my last 6 months on, and it's completely changed the way that we made the following decisions for an arts program in the, you know, in the north of England, or the way we kind of, you know, worked on a kind of social protection program in inner cities in the United States. Like, recognizing that, like, you know, however imperfect we're able to convey this, it can still help you all kind of be more successful the things that you care about is just like it's an incredible privilege to be able to do that. And so I thought approaching teaching with this notion that, look, like, I have this opportunity to share this gift to help people kind of be better at what they want to do, like, that's, it's crazy that somebody paid me to do that job, right? It's crazy that somebody paid me to do that job. And so that was like, and so the thing that I tried to change when I joined the program, and look, I love the fact that the School of Public Policy exists as an entity in and of itself now, because there's so many kind of fights of like, you're this wonderful hybrid, right? Between people who really want to make decisions that are pragmatic and being able to bring the technical skills there. And you'll see in lots of things, there's this natural tension between kind of what is econometrics for its sake, or microeconomic theory for its own sake, or macro theory for its own sake, and what is actually useful for making decisions. The biggest thing that I try to do is find points of contact between the stuff that you all care about and the technical skills that we have. So, you know, one little example, you know, we changed some of the assignments within the class to say, look, I'm going to give you a big, messy set of data from the World Bank, and I want you just to come up with something that's interesting for you and to write 5 pages using some econometrics about what you can learn from some of this data that may inform a public policy decision that you like. And I narrowed it more than that, but like, it varied from year to year. And what was amazing, it was the first time that many of those technical skills had been brought to bear in a world where the shades of gray were sort of embraced, right? It wasn't, you know, tell me about whether or not this is the right standard error on this term, but tell me what I can learn from this particular bit of data. And every year, kind of 3 or 4 students would use their paper as part of their job applications. And so they'd go out and they'd get jobs at places like the OECD or the UN based on saying, look, here's what I did with data to answer a question the best I could, kind of handing that off. And I just love that. Like, that made me like extremely happy, right? It was wonderful to see, hey, here's this interface between being able to use this technical material to then actually, you know, find insights that you care about and then show that the ability to generate those insights is actually valuable to organizations whose mission you care about. Like that's just great, right? I mean, how can you not be excited about that?
That makes me happy and excited. Thank you.
So, got to do my part.
So Fanlayer, you have been waiting
for. Adnan, look, but to be fair, I don't, let me sorry to interrupt, but Adnan, you do that as well, right? Like one of the amazing things about the program is, look, like your research, which shows up in the, you know, in the QJE and like is incredibly well regarded by academics, is also all about figuring out how to, on a pragmatic sense, to allow people to policymakers to make better decisions, to be more successful at delivering on the outcomes they care about. And I think that resonance kind of fits throughout the program. And it's one of the things that's just like, there are lots of different ways to do this, right? Like mine was just one way, but I think the notion that the kind of technical skills, as long as you take them with the appropriate grain of salt, can really lead to much better decisions is just a great thing that you should always keep in mind, right? Like in all your classes, like ask kind of what can I actually do with this? How is this going to be useful for actually achieving the goals that I actually care about? And that's what this program I think is great at.
Thank you. Very well said. And that's also like our motto, our mission at the School of Public Policy also. So that's what we, so Vanessa, you want to come in and then sorry, finally, and then you're next.
I want to make a little interruption here just to create more dynamic, but I just wanted to ask you, Greg, you said that when you taught econometrics, you told students that you would help them take all that data and turn it into knowledge. How do you feel about that in the current post-factual world, where we're seeing a lot of leadership and a lot of public policymakers saying, for example, in my country, no, well, yeah, we're not growing. Forget about that minus 0.3%. That's not relevant. We're going to create, better tools for the people to live better. I mean, how can you manage those two trends and those two contexts? Thank you, Greg.
So I guess my answer to that question is really cheap, right? Which is that, like, I have the luxury of working with people who don't live in a post-factual world, right? For whom, at least on the financial side, their outcomes are measured rigorously and they are held ruthlessly accountable for what those outcomes are. And so although, as we all know, like the notion of thinking about impact still has lots of kind of squishiness. There's a lot of kind of gray area about what constitutes impact, and people can, the phrase comes out there all the time, kind of greenwashing or impact washing, where there is an ability to kind of make up answers. I have the luxury of dealing with people for whom the bedrock of what they do is something where real rigorous quantitative accountability is the norm. And so there's not much escaping that. And so, I find that the fact that, one of the challenges is that, that does mean that some people are kind of keen to engage in some impact washing and say, look, what I really want to do is tell a story that might be supported by data, because the people that they're working with kind of, if you're thinking about the big investors in the world, sovereign wealth funds, big pension funds and high net worth individuals, like they can spot BS a mile away, right? But they like numbers. And so because it's hard to understand a lot of impact, you can, in the Mark Twain sense, you can do a pretty good job of lying with statistics for them. And so I think a big piece of my job is helping kind of identify that there is a path. It's not a kind of a well-defined path. It's definitely not a path that we're guaranteed to walk successfully, but a path to at least move the rigor and the credibility of the way in which we measure impact towards that rigor with which people approach financial outcomes. But because I generally work in a world where that sense of rigor for the financial outcomes is so well-defined, it's a lot easier to have that as kind of a North Star for the type of things that we do. Look, I can always say to people, look, we want this to be as credible as financial outcomes. Yes, net income might mean different things to different people, but there's a rough reference point and you can dig through notes and ultimately it all shows up in the cash flow. We want to have an analog in the impact world to that, and that makes my life easy. In your world and in the world of a lot of people who are policymakers, that post-truth world is something that I guess the best I can say is I'm glad I don't have to operate that on a regular basis. I would like to believe that ultimately kind of truth will out, but there's lots of evidence that says that maybe the arc of the kind of the universe does not bend towards kind of more kind of kind of sensible thinking about policy. I'd love to hear, Vanessa, your answer to that, and Andres yours as well. I get to cheat, right? I work in a piece of the policy world where we're forced to have more credibility and accountability because there's no way around it.
Thanks, Greg.
Can I say one thing about that? I mean, I'll say two things about that. You have just heard an econometrician quote Martin Luther King talk about the arc of history. That makes him an unusual econometrician. Although he didn't tell us what the quote was. I think all of us who are in public life and in public policy struggle with Vanessa's very good question. I don't have a good answer, but let me tell you about what direction I would think about. In the end, what matters is not so much what is said, but who says it. There was an old, you know, I'm a macro guy, and it's an old paper that a colleague at NYU wrote, which was called Credibility of Policies versus Credibility of Policymakers. They're not the same thing. So I think that in the end, if you're a good political leader or a good policymaker, what you say can be BS or what you say can be true, and many people won't be able to tell the difference. But the way to make it credible and to make, you know, to use jargon, to move from a pooling equilibrium to a separating equilibrium, in which, you know, bullshit and not bullshit are told apart, is to build a professional reputation and a personal reputation. And that makes a very big difference. Of course, that in some sense only pushes the question to a different domain, because Adnan might say, or Vanessa might say, well, how do you do that in a world in which people are going to try to tar you with, you know, unjustified accusations, or in which Twitter is going to tear you apart? That's hard. But at least that's the way I would begin to think about the question.
Well said,
Andres. To that point, Andres, like that's also, look, like we take for granted a lot of the way we measure things in finance. But look, that's the history of financial accounting, right? Like, you know, for those of us who actually have looked at an accounting statement because we've had to any time in the, you know, in the last 10 years, you kind of take for granted a lot of these measures, and you forget the fact that, like, there was no comparability before 1926, right? Like, you know, you think about the railroads in the United States all just made up their own numbers, and they declared revenue in a way that was almost inscrutable to anybody that you couldn't sit down and have five drinks with at the club to kind of get a sense of what, you know, what was actually happening there. And over time, there were a set of rules that were put in place that kind of said, hey, here's some facts that we might all want to have. And those facts only got credibility when you actually saw that they kind of turned into ultimate outcomes, right? That you said, look, you're telling me that this is what your income is, but now let me see how much money kind of shows up in my account from dividend payments for the next 5 years. And over time, these values kind of gained and lost credibility by how well they accorded with facts on the ground ultimately. And I think, you know, one of the, you know, the opportunities, at least from the piece of what I do, which tends to be much more, in a sense, on the micro side, is the ability to draw a much closer link between the kind of things that you can measure and report and the kind of things that people actually experience. Because there's a sort of learned credibility to those facts themselves. And if they have the credentialing from sets of people who you actually believe, very much in the distinction between kind of, you know, the policy versus the policymaker credibility that Andres referenced, people will start giving some credibility to what's the analog of the policy, because they say, wait a minute, like when you report net income this way, it's actually meaningful. When you report your impact or your carbon footprint, I know that that's no longer BS, right? Because we now have people who measure this, and you can tell me something about what that is. And that credibility can evolve in certain sectors over time. What that means for politics writ large, kind of above my pay grade by so many levels, but you can build credibility by, you know, kind of slowly over time. Kind of it accretes because it's earned.
Thank you, Greg. We have a number of students who have been waiting patiently. Let's have Fanley and Luis in this round, and then Santiago and Dipali in the next round.
Hi, I'm Yasmin. I'm a second year MPA student. So there is a large fragmentation in measurement frameworks and tools in impact measurement and management. And at the LSE, we learned about RCTs as one of the tools to evaluate policy interventions or even social businesses in the impact investing sphere. So I was wondering, because some people argue for a more unified and homogeneous approach in impact measurement and management, and also it's less accessible for some people to use RCTs because they're costly, they require a lot of resources. How could we make impact investing more mainstream? And what are your thoughts on standardization in this field? Also coming back to your point of accounting, where we did not have this kind of standardization a few decades ago. Thanks.
Thank you, Jasmine. Great, Lewis, I think he also has a question on impact investing. Lewis, can you unmute, please unmute yourself?
Thanks, Khan. So I'm Lewis from the MPP program, and my background is in impact investment and advisory, having had a chance to work with DFI back in Kenya. And my main concern for today is there has been in the recent past or in the recent time periods, we've seen changes in the sense how DFIs are looking at investments in the global south, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, and together with other big funds that they're even now willing to look at small ticket size deals with big appetite for risk. It's a phenomenon that they wouldn't have quite encouraged in the past years. So are there gaps that you've identified in your work? Are there policy gaps specifically that you've already identified? And how relevant stakeholders in this, maybe from government and even advisory individuals, can actually focus their efforts on to try and help and improve the deal flow in sub-Saharan region?
Great question. Okay. Should we take one more, or you want me to get these two? I'll go with these two. So look, Esmond, it's a great question about the fragmentation and measurement. In answering the question, I think it's worth distinguishing between kind of fragmentation in measurement tools and fragmentation in metrics, right? So, you know, you focused a bit on thinking about, you know, some people saying, look, you know, should I use RCT? Should there be some standardization about how I measure things? That's one side, right? Which is the, if I want to think about what the outcome is or what the impact compared to a counterfactual is as measured in a sort of a real sense, right? Like, you know, how many more kids, you know, or, you know, what were vaccination rates if I provided lentils when I was kind of, you know, as an encouragement giving out the vaccines versus not, right? There's a set of tools used to measure these outcomes or impacts. And then there's a set of kind of accepted metrics that people might kind of use or report along the way there. And I think that it's important to distinguish between those two things. So let me start with the measurement tool side. Look, I think that the reality is that there are certainly going to be some people out there who have very strong views about what constitutes evidence, right? There's definitely a set of people, you know, sometimes referred to as the randomista crowd, and who believe that if the evidence doesn't come from a randomized controlled trial, it's not evidence at all, it's just noise, right? That's a set that exists. I think it's thankfully a shrinking set, but there still are kind of people of that framework. You know, there's another set of folks out there who, I don't want to kind of impugn folks, but who believe, look, I can just make sense out of kind of correlations and differences in means, and all this talk of econometrics is useless to me. Just kind of give me some measures. I think that, even if we had kind of a normative sense of kind of what actually really constituted evidence, there wouldn't be a one size fits all solution to it. You're right that there are some cases where randomized control trials are extremely costly, right? And, you know, they're the kind of things that governments can't afford to do. There are other cases where they're just a natural way of doing business, right? Like if you thought about, you know, who's done the most randomized control trials in the world, like at first instinct, you might say, well, like maybe I want to think about the folks at J-PAL from an academic perspective, or the people at DIME, the group that kind of does these things within the World Bank. But the right answer to that question is the people who do the most RCTs are Walmart, kind of Capital One credit cards, and whom else am I kind of forgetting here? Amazon. Right. So, you know, if you read kind of a website like the Huffington Post, right, like I bring them up because they run randomized control trials of what headlines they should be putting on the articles. Like they're not out there looking for a £500,000 grant from the UK government to figure out kind of how to do this. They're doing this because it allows them to be more successful at driving traffic to, you know, to articles. Like I've gone out and run experiments with large Chinese electronics manufacturers where like we just said, look, here's a way that you do your hiring policy and the way you provide support to your employees. You're not sure about which way to do it. Let's actually run a randomized control trial that just embeds in your ordinary course of business. Like it's there's the only incremental cost is we're going to measure a couple additional things, but we're going to give you an answer that doesn't come in kind of 6 years. It's going to come in 6 weeks and it's going to change the way you run your business. And so I think that the thing that I would encourage you to take from all of your studies, it's not just the econometric side, but try and take like what the kernel is, like what is the core insight that you get from it? It's not, I want to go out and run an RCT that looks like kind of, you know, the beautiful kind of Bandiera and et al. Experiment, you know, for looking at ultra poor programs in Bangladesh. That's an amazing paper. It's wonderful that they did that. It changed the way people think about it. But if what you're saying is, look, what I really need to know is my program, policy, or product having the desired effect, and how should I allocate my resources between, say, choice A, choice B, and choice C? The notion of how you understand things like selection bias, the ability to have a sense of what the certainty is. I'll avoid kind of technical stuff, but kind of thinking about how confident I am that this is the right choice, like that is broadly applicable and can lead you to what is kind of the optimal way to answer your question in different settings. In some cases, the best thing you can do is say, look, I can't actually conduct a normal evaluation, but there's some things that I ought to see if this is working, and I'll just learn that I can measure those things. There's lots of ways through that path of evidence. And I sincerely hope that there won't be sort of a restriction of what that set is, but it would be nice if we could figure out a better, more credible, more acceptable way. And this involves both kind of, in a sense, policies and policymakers in kind of doing this, to be able to knit that evidence together in a sensible way. So we don't have to think of everything as completely binary, right? This is either the truth or it's completely worthless. There's a way to kind of put these pieces together. And I think lots of folks are working on that, but that's a piece of kind of measurement tools. There's another side, which is the metrics, which is, so imagine a concrete example. You're thinking about kind of, you know, investing in, or you're a policymaker who's deciding, you know, what are the educational outcomes in a, you know, that we can affect, and what programs, policies, what businesses we can support to help improve educational outcomes. There's a question of kind of what is the set of things that you want to measure in order to see that you're making progress. And naturally, one of the challenges of that is that if you leave it up to the organization or the entities themselves to choose those, as nice as that might be, it also leads to cherry picking, right? I pick the thing that makes me look the best. I get to mark my own homework in a sense. Like if I write a really bad essay, I'm gonna grade my essay on handwriting because I have lovely handwriting, right? And so, gosh, like Greg gets an A+ because gosh, it's just almost calligraphy in the way he wrote it, even if it's nonsense throughout. Right? You don't want to give people that kind of space. And so there's a need to have some set of metrics if we want to hold ourselves accountable in some way. And there, you know, in the same way that happened for financial accounting, you know, there needs to be some kind of movement towards a standard. Some of that's happening. I won't get into technical details, but right now we're in the sort of, you know, let kind of, you know, many flowers bloom kind of phase of things. But more and more, there's a sense of, hey, look, we need to come to some agreement. So there's some standardization. So when I say, look, I've improved educational outcomes by something that's worth, you know, $10 million a year, you have a standard to judge kind of what that means relative to what you're doing. And so I think that, you know, we're not quite at that kind of consolidation phase fully yet, but, you know, there was kind of a big merger of two of the standard setters within the impact space just 3 days ago announced, and people are starting to recognize that having some comparability is useful. But, you know, it's for a variety of reasons that I'm probably happy to get into when I teach the course that Andres has been asking me to teach on I think I'm saying there's a reason to not harmonize on that just yet. And so, yeah. And then Lewis, to your question about kind of, you know, opportunities and kind of changes in the way that DFIs are looking at investments in the Global South, and in particular, sort of, you know, a greater willingness to look at small ticket sizes. look, I think there's a lot of variation in that. I think one of the things that a number of DFIs have done is actually recognize that and give themselves a little bit of slack to say, we don't have to make exclusively direct investments. So I think one of the real innovations that's happened in kind of DFI investment in the Global South and being able to target smaller ticket sizes is the ability to invest in funds that themselves kind of make the case back to the DFI for their impact, and then allow a cost structure that makes it possible to, you know, to make kind of, you know, $500,000 investments, which would never show up on the radar screen of an IFC, you know, an IFC or, you know, African Development Bank or whatnot. And so I think that's, you know, one piece of it. I think that they're, you know, the DFIs, you know, my perspective in spending a lot of time chatting with them, and by the way, spending a lot of time doesn't mean that I know anything about, because they are kind of complicated entities with very, I guess, kind of, you know, challenging internal political economy issues is the best way I would describe it. But I think that there's, like, they are all still trying to figure out exactly how they really kind of want to play this game, how they want to evaluate themselves, right? The notion of kind of the private sector moving into impact investing has forced people to clarify their thinking a bit about kind of what constitutes impact. And in many ways, they still don't know exactly what they mean. So, you know, I won't kind of, you know, name any direct names here, but, you know, I've talked, you know, to one kind of, you know, very large DFI who has said, look, like, we actually don't know kind of whether or not additionality is actually something that is important for what we do. Now, what does that mean? Like, additionality means, like, can I convince myself that my investment actually made a difference? So I might say I'm going out investing in a kind of off-grid solar business. And if I just looked at the impact of that business, it's reducing the, you know, the carbon footprint of the entire grid, kind of, you know, changing, you know, the way, in a sense, kind of the way energy provision works. But, like, is it the case that these guys wouldn't have got funding but for me? You know, that's a really hard answer and fundamental to the way DFIs work, particularly when they look at markets that are you know, really inefficient in many ways, which is certainly the equity market in sub-Saharan Africa. So people are kind of trying to redefine the way they're approaching this. And I think that there's a lot of work to be done in helping guide their thinking in a way that can actually direct financial resources to effective use. I think the one concrete piece that I think I've seen as the first order impediment to every investor who's looking particularly in investing in sub-Saharan Africa is currency risk. And, you know, this is one that, you know, Andres can probably speak to, you know, kind of more directly than I can, but, you know, the provision of some analog, look, it's easy to kind of, like, you know, it's relatively easy to hedge like US dollar, Mexican peso risk. Like, that's a market that exists. You can figure out ways to do that. It's harder to hedge against the BRRRR. Right, like that market just doesn't really, you know, doesn't really exist, or even against the Nairu, right? It's hard, right? And so no one's really stepped into that, and that is a really serious issue for a lot of investors. And so if someone can come up with a smart way to actually solve that problem, the World Bank had an approach to this that, you know, they offered up a kind of currency hedging fund that had exactly zero takers over the course of 2 years, despite lots of publicity around it. If somebody can figure out a way to kind of crack that animal and create kind of the, you know, a kind of currency insurance that allows people to divvy up risk in a way that can bring in equity investors and bond investors, I think that's a big kind of nut to crack. You know, the other is figuring out kind of, you know, ways to fit that kind of middle slot of debt between what you get from this proliferation of kind of SME finance folks and what you actually get, you know, out of the kind of, you know, the larger sort of bond markets. There's kind of a missing middle in that space. No one's kind of cracked that, and it creates a funding gap for a lot of African enterprises that are trying to grow. But, like, somebody on this call might be the person who solves that, right? And there are probably other issues out there that would make a real difference. But I think there's, you know, there are lots of things to do to make that market more efficient and kind of more beneficial for everybody in it.
Thank you, Greg. I sincerely hope that someone who is on this call will help take on some of these transformative challenges. So we have two more people who want to come in, Santiago Duque and Dipali. Over to you.
Hello, Greg. And my name is Santiago. I'm a second year MPA student. We are taking a course in international political economy and development, and we have seen that sometimes foreign aid can have political intentions. Or even when it doesn't have political intentions, some international institutions can have overlapping jobs and they can lose efficiency overall. So my question is, to what extent do you think that impact investment firms cooperate, or the lack of cooperation, and to what extent do you think that is important? Or conversely, do you think that the competition of impact investing firms can bring more efficiency to the public service and goods delivery?
Okay, so let's have the second question as well. Deepali, I think it's Deepali Masirkar. So
yes. Hi, Greg, this is Deepali, I'm MPA second year. So we all know it's the current hot topic, impact investment, and we see it as the solution to a lot of socioeconomic problems in the developing world. But I want to understand how difficult is the collaboration and coordination, the cross-sectoral coordination. I mean, then what I mean is you have the government, you have the private sector, you have the NGOs, and each of them, the structures are different, the policies are different, the incentives are different. You just mentioned about the private sector not being sure of what they want to do. So how difficult it is, and how difficult is the coordination then?
Great question. Okay, was over, there
to
one
you,
more
over to you, Greg.
Okay. So Santiago, your question about kind of your international political economy and development, I think that, I'm largely going to punt on the answer to your question because I really don't know. And I think that there are good reasons to think that competition from impact investors, and not even just, competition, but the presence of impact investors, could improve the efficiency of many other activities, right? So you find that, you have a company like, like Zipline, which is an investment that the Rise Fund made, which is this drone delivery service for medical products, right? Turns out that in lots of places from, mountainous Rwanda to pretty much anywhere outside the two big cities in Ghana, it's just really hard to get access to everything from kind of blood to necessary medicines. These guys from NASA and from Jet Propulsion Laboratories kind of, got together, came up with this really young, kind of brilliant guy, kind of came up with an idea of, look, we can use drones and kind of, get these supplies, out to people at, within 4 hours. And by the way, at a fraction of the cost, given what the road quality is like and kind of running that. That has actually, in order to provide that service, that's led to much more careful measurement and figuring out how they get information kind of, from the hospitals, from the medical centers, and that in turn kind of creates a public good for other medical, product and service providers to actually improve the quality of their service delivery. I think that, there's some kind of, positive externality to some of these things that doesn't necessarily have to run through the, through the competition side. But you can certainly see it having, in some cases, kind of, negative ramifications. One of the examples, and you may see this paper in, in your classes, is thinking about kind of, the provision of private water services in Argentina and how there's some pretty clear evidence that led to degradation of the public services. There's some evidence of that in the provision of private schooling, kind of leading to some degradation of the provision of public or state schooling. And so, you can see things working in different directions. I don't think there's a sort of global answer to that. But I think, one of the things to highlight is probably in part an answer to Deepali to your question of kind of, in a sense, how difficult is that cross-sector collaboration? Because I think that some of the things that you want to think about is how you can harness kind of what the good is of whether or not it's impact investing or whether or not it's, people who are kind of engaging in civil society and kind of, lobbying rules for, say, requiring people to kind of, disclose kind of what their carbon footprint is, or to audit their supply chains, to look for slave labor somewhere, within that supply chain. Like, there's an opportunity to find ways where, and I think, some of the skills that you'll, a lot of the skills that you'll learn in the MPA program will help you identify where these opportunities or kind of risks are, is to say, look, where do we actually need to build better systems for coordination? And I think that, there are a number of entities out there that are trying to figure out ways to knit these together in a sensible way. Right. So, one example would be the folks at Omidyar, who are, it's a, a big foundation. They're folks who are out there active in the impact investing space. And, at one level, they make investments that are in commercial rate of return impact investments. Like, at the other end of the spectrum, they engage in lobbying activities to try and change policies that they think are relevant. And they have very much a systems view of how these pieces fit together. because oftentimes many of the private market, potential private market solutions are dependent upon an effective bit of public market or a policy provision or other sort of enabling, you know, features, infrastructure and, you know, and the like. And so they try to think about kind of an entire problem and see how they can fit those pieces together. In some cases, they look like they have some nice incipient success, but it's, you know, it's challenging. And look, that's a challenge, not just for how kind of impact investors integrate elsewhere in the market. You know, that's a challenge throughout kind of take all of foreign aid. Like one of the big complaints about foreign aid is just how poorly integrated and how poorly coordinated it is. I mean, I remember, gosh, this is now must be, you know, 15 years ago, we were kind of, you know, doing some work of trying to do help some folks out doing some health surveys in Lesotho. And it turned out that concurrently there were, I think, and I might be misremembering the number, but it's roughly on the order of 13 different surveys that were going on at the same time, right? Looking at almost the same issues, but with sample frames that were defined independently and with variable definitions that didn't have a sensible crosswalk. And so everybody had these kind of underpowered, undersized surveys that if somebody would have just said, hey, you guys need to talk to one another, right? And actually just do one of these, you could have done it at a fraction of a cost, made it much more useful. Those coordination failures abound everywhere. And so finding ways to develop systems that solve those coordination failures is something that's, you know, not just the issue of impact investing, it's just kind of a much broader issue. The hope of impact investing is that it harnesses market forces to solve some of this. But I think we all know that markets don't work perfectly. And part of the reason why impact investing should exist, and Andres, you and I have had this conversation many times, is to think about ways to have, in a sense, almost an intermediate solution for where there are market failures, right? And hopefully, like carbon pricing is a great example. You know, you have a market of the private sector implicitly pricing carbon with the hope that eventually we get to something that approximates the Peruvian tax on carbon that we all want, right? But in the interim, the private market shouldn't stay on the side. Figuring out how to integrate those processes together is something that is, you know, is a real opportunity and a real challenge. Sorry, did that answer your question, Dipali and Santiago? Even if the answer was, I don't know.
Okay.
Yes, so, to some extent.
You can also, we still have a couple of minutes left. You can ask a follow-up question if you want. Dipali?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. So that was a fascinating discussion. We still have a couple of minutes left. So unless someone has a burning question, I want to give you some time for reflection. What advice would you give to, you've already given it quite a lot, like for our students, MPP or MPA students, many of whom already have policy experience and many of whom will be engaging with policy in different positions, some in the private sector, some NGOs, some are already working or plan to work in governments. Some want to run for offices, which is elected offices, which is again something great. So any advice that you would give them to how to best prepare for their future roles?
It's a small question like that. Let's see. So look, I'm gonna cheat again and actually echo something that, you know, that Vanessa said early on of everything in life gives you a lesson, right? And I think that, you know, approaching everything you do, but particularly at this kind of just wonderfully rich time that is the MPA and MPP program, as, you know, asking yourself the question of what can I learn from this? What can I take from this that that will enable me to do kind of great things, right? And I think that if you approach everything with the recognition that, like, the program is not just throwing crap at you, right? Like, people have thought really hard about the types of things that you can use. I mean, some of those things kind of might not be, you know, where you're going to find yourself kind of making a difference, but I would interrogate everything you see with the lens of, like, what can I take that's useful from this, right? Discard what's left, right? If I can at least paraphrase Martin Luther King, I'll paraphrase, you know, Bruce Lee as well. Like, you know, take from all the different systems that are out there, kind of take what is useful and discard the rest. And then what you want to keep is kind of what you feel is useful to you. The one thing that I would say is, you know, as we talked about these sort of hybrid careers, I would have a bit of, in a sense, kind of humility about the threshold that you set for what is useful, because I think you'll be really surprised about some of the things that you actually see right now and you think, I have no idea how that could apply, right? And then you find yourself in a job kind of 2 years from now where suddenly you say, wait a minute, like that insight from that class that I took on international political economy, it like really frames the way I ought to be thinking about this. And if I look at it that way, I can actually kind of see through to kind of the crux and actually make a real difference. And so I would have a bit of faith that people have tried to think pretty long and hard about what are the useful set of tools that you can have and try and put those in your toolkit, you know, with the aspiration of making a real difference. Cause that's, you know, like that's why I hope most of you came to the MPA or MPP program to kind of, you know, meet some super interesting people and to tool yourselves up in a way that allows you to kind of do more than you could otherwise. And that's, and I would approach everything with that kind of passion for, hey, like I'm going to put this in my toolkit because someday this will make me better at something that I care passionately about. Even if right now you look out at kind of standard errors and think, dear God, why is someone teaching this to me? Right. At some point, an understanding of uncertainty and how you make decisions under uncertainty is likely to be relevant for you. And so try and understand as much as possible to kind of put that in your toolkit for doing great stuff.
Very well said.
That's all I got.
If you ever needed an advertising for why decision making under uncertainty is important, I think COVID, the whole experience that we have had this year has highlighted why that those concepts are important. So unless you want to say the final word, I just wanted to thank Greg and everyone on this call. It is always a great pleasure to talk either individually or collectively with Greg. I always learn something new. Andres, you want to say something?
I just want to say thank you. This was fun. It was instructive. I think we all learn a lot. I enjoyed it as much as students, I'm sure, did. And so, Greg, we want to see you at the SPP more often as possible.
I will like that as well. Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure meeting you guys, and I hope to see you all in person when the world allows. So, yeah.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everyone.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Be well, everybody. Yeah. Bye-bye.